Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning. My name is Shaylin, and I'm a Senior Health Motion Specialist here at PTCC. I'll be moderating today's webinar, Tobacco Control in Ontario. How well are we doing, and where can we improve? Findings from OTRU's Annual Strategy Monitoring Report. If you're having trouble logging into the webinar, please call the 1-800 number for PTCC. This help number is 1-800-363-7822. For those of you who are logged into our webinar, you'll see the presentation on your right. On the left hand of the screen, you'll see a chat box. We have set aside time for questions during and after the presentation, but at any time during the presentation, feel free to enter any questions or comments into this box and we'll address them when we can. We may not answer the questions in order, but we'll do our best to answer each question at the appropriate time. Please note that during today's webinar, the phone lines will be muted to minimize background noise. Just before we begin, we'd like to get a better sense of how many have joined us today. Please indicate how many people are attending today's webinar with you by simply clicking on the circle beside the appropriate number in the polling question on your screen. Thanks very much, everyone. Now I'd like to introduce you to our presenters. Dr. Rob Schwartz is the Executive Director of the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit and Associate Professor at the Jawaharlal Nehru School of Public Health, University of Toronto, with interest in research, evaluation, and knowledge exchange. Sean O'Connor is a Senior Research Associate at OTRU. Sean is an expert in the surveillance of tobacco control outcomes. Sean leads the Strategy Evaluation Working Group at OTRU, which produces the report being discussed today. Take it away, Rob and Sean.
Thanks very much. Good morning, everybody. We're looking forward to a good discussion and happy to have your input and your interpretation of the results that we are going to present today. Sean's going to start us off. He'll do the first half, and I'll chime in during the second half. Go ahead, Sean.
Great. Well, thanks, everybody, for signing up, and we'll just get going with the this year's strategy report. So we're going to just start with a little bit of discussion of the report itself, what comprises the report, and some of the conclusions of the report. Then we're going to flip into some of the data from the report, the results of the report for key indicators. So by way of introduction, we're going to just discuss a few of these key components here, and then we'll move on. So this is this report is over 20 years. It's an annual report, started in 1994, and we're very happy to produce or present this report here today. So the report has the following chapters, and we're going to be discussing a little bit from each of these. We're going to highlight tobacco use, youth prevention, and smoking cessation, as well as protection. Rob is going to pick it up at smoking cessation protection, and he's going to conclude with a few notes at the end of the report. I'll be discussing the introduction, tobacco use, and youth prevention. So the main chapters that are with respect to prevention, cessation, and protection, they kind of start off with talking about the SFO infrastructure and interventions that are available. We go on to provide evaluation and monitoring information where it's available. So we get into reach and we get into effect to the extent that's possible, which are the contributions of the programs and policies. And we wrap that up by looking at macro indicators, both long-term and short-term indicators with respect to prevention, protection, and cessation. So the conclusions of the report are informed by many of these boxes and a few other sources as well. We have the guidance documents from the ministry. We have the Scientific Advisory Committee and the MPower, which is from the World Health Organization. And these last two, the Scientific Advisory Committee and the MPower, are used in each of the chapter's conclusion sections to kind of benchmark where we are with respect to some of their guidelines and statements of where tobacco control, comprehensive tobacco control should be. We also rely on past O2 reports, and the O2 principal investigators review the document before its dissemination. So we're going to go over a number of key issues that we're going to focus on today and that the report also focuses on. So one of these is tobacco use different from cigarette use. We'll be looking at whether emerging products are an issue. And we'll be also looking at whether smoking increases gradually with age or does the rate jump. Are Ontarians quitting smoking? Is there a need for an increase in price tax? Are we finished with protection? So those are some of the issues that we're looking at. Overall, we both in the conclusions and kind of the structure of the report, I mean, one of the goals are to assess how we're making out with respect to goals. And so here are some goals listed. The ministry has jumped in and has said that Ontario wants to be the lowest jurisdiction in Canada with the smoking rate. It's always interesting to look at BC versus Ontario because BC traditionally has had the lowest rate. So we'll, as we move on in the presentation today, we'll see where we land with respect to BC. 5 percentage point decrease in 5 years is another goal that's been stated. In the past 5 years, we've reached about 2 percentage points, which is a significant decline. The U.S. Surgeon General's report, Canadian Public Health Association, and ALPHA have all kind of come out with claims or statements that let's work towards a tobacco-free generation, and let that be the next generation. So we're going to start with some of the high-level summary first, as opposed to the end. And so the good news is that among high school students, we see that past 30-day smoking of cigarettes is down by 60% over the last decade. So that's really a tremendous accomplishment that the SFO has achieved. And we'll be digging into that age group, you know, the prevention typically looks at youth and young adults. We'll be looking at that in more detail. And the message when you get into the detail is a little bit mixed. Another piece of good news is cessation training and professional development is supported. So, you know, there's a fair amount of infrastructure has been developed over the last decade, and we'll be mentioning that, and the report dwells into that further. Free smoking cessation medications for Ontario drug benefit recipients. So that's a good news story. And there's been additional protection from secondhand smoke exposure. So we'll jump into that in more detail in the protection discussion today, and the protection chapter has more details. The last good news. Well, we'll find that there's increasing use of emerging products like e-cigarettes and water pipe. Young adult use remains high. Quit attempts and long-term quit attempts are stable. And from a population level perspective, I think as Rob will show, you know, we need to increase quit attempts. We need to get more people quitting. We need to get them quitting more often. Secondhand smoke exposure is high among youth in public places at 25%, homes and cars. It's still high, and we'll get into that a little bit more detail in the protection section. 3 in 10 Ontarians are exposed to secondhand smoke in MUDs, multi-unit dwellings. So how are we doing with respect to the MPower and SAC standards? Well, we're not doing too bad for some of these. So we have patio bans in place now, flavor bans, partial flavor bans, not including menthol. Monitoring and evaluation is supported and it's doing reasonably well. And targeting high-risk in youth and young adults. That's partial support for that. We could do better, but we have some initiatives on the go. Cessation throughout the health system, there's progress there. So here's where we're not doing so well. Taxes. We really haven't had much of a tax increase over the last couple of years, and as Rob, I think, will present, the tax rate in Ontario is quite low relative to the other jurisdictions in Canada. Mass media, social marketing, insufficient. We really don't have ongoing mass media social marketing. We have campaigns every couple of years, it seems, for a few months, but nothing sustained long during, 12 months out of the year type of thing every year. Universal coverage for cessation support, not there yet. Adult ratings for smoking in movies, not there yet. Select indoor and outdoor public places. While I mentioned before, there are some there's definitely some progress here. There are still, like I say, select indoor and outdoor public places that need greater protection. So that's kind of a high-level look. We're going to get into some details now, and we're going to go through the second chapter in the monitoring report is tobacco use. So we're going to go look at what the prevalence of various substances are.
Just for those of you who may not be aware, the full report is now available. It's on our website, www.otru.org, and you may want to open that up and follow along, look at some of the results. What we're presenting today are only some of the highlights. There's a lot more data, a lot more information, and a lot more interpretation in the full report.
Great. So tobacco use. So 19.6% in 2014. Now that includes cigarette, cigar, smokeless, and pipe. Nothing else, just those substances. And that's a significant decrease over the 22.1% reported in 2010. So that's a good news story. So in a five-year period, it's gone down a couple percent. Is tobacco use different from cigarette use? Tobacco use being, as I mentioned, cigarette, cigar, pipe, cigarillo, smokeless. So we have a poll question here, and which products have the highest rate of past 30-day use among Ontarians aged 12 years and older? Cigarettes versus all other tobacco products combined, being cigar, pipe, smokeless, chew, this doesn't include e-cigarette or water pipe.
Does not include.
That's right, yeah. And the reason it doesn't include, in part, is methodologically, the data sources we use don't have all these substances on any given survey. So it's unfortunate. We have to go and look at different data sources. The reason being, for the most part, is that e-cigarette and water pipe are a recent phenomenon. It takes several years to get all these products up in survey questions asked, which we've begun to do, but there's still some holes in the surveillance systems that are out there. Namely, Canadian Community Health Survey doesn't have any questions on e-cigarettes or water pipe at this point. Great. All right, so we're still getting responses in, and so what we're looking for is what's the highest prevalence, cigarettes or all the other products combined? Cigarillos, little cigars, pipe, smokeless tobacco, including chew and snuff. All right, so why don't we just take a break here? There's still a few people answering, but this is the answer. So cigarette use by far is the most common substance out there in the past 30-day use, 17% compared to the other ones, which are, you can see, cigar is 4 plus 1 is 5, 6, 7, less than 7% for all those other substances. So 7 thereabouts versus 17, not even close. The 17%, just as an FYI, this is defined as past 30-day use. In the rest of the report, we define cigarette use as past 30-day use and have smoked 100 cigarettes in a lifetime. And when you do that, cigarette use does drop down to 16-something. The reason we've kept it here at 17 is because we just looked at past 30-day use, because these other questions only ask past 30-day use. You can't break them down by asking how much of the product has been used. For cigarette use, we have done that. So, all right. So we're going to switch to some other substances now. So this is CAMH monitor. So this is 18 years and over. So we can see here, amongst the whole adult population, e-cigarette use isn't particularly high. It's 3%, you know, and that compares to, you know, the 16-17% for cigarette. Past year use is 10%. Lifetime use is 13%. There's not much difference between past year use and lifetime use because it's a recent phenomenon, right? E-cigarettes have only been around for, you know, 5 years, have only been catching on the last couple of years. So that's why lifetime use is almost identical to past year use. Water pipe use, lifetime. This is CTADs. So 15 years and over, 8%. So lower than e-cigarette use. Cigar use, this number was reported before, I guess 4% for 12 years and older. That's the past month. However, when you break it down by age and by sex, you get a different story here. It was 4% for the population, 12 years and over. We see there's an age and gender difference here, though, right? We see that cigar use is really an issue with young adult males. 10% 18 to 19 year olds. So just a quick kind of aside here. All these charts on the right hand side where it says percent, that's the percent that are engaged in the that's the prevalence of the behavior that we're looking at. So we see for 18 and 19 year olds, the bottom is the category, and in this case it's age. The green bar is female, the purple bar is male, and we see male has 10, so that's 10% prevalence. 10% of males age 18 and 19 have used cigars in the past month, so that's going to be throughout. So just one important thing is that left-hand side is the prevalence from 0 upwards to 100%. But for this right now, we see that young adult males have quite a bit of prevalence here for cigar use. And I guess the good news is with the prohibition of flavors, there's a good chance that these could go down.
And just to clarify, cigar use includes cigarillos.
That's right, yeah. The question on it's a CCH question, and the question asks, have you smoked cigars in the past 30 days? So we have to assume that it's not clear from the question if that includes, you know, cigarillos, little cigars. You just get that question and people have to answer. So we're assuming that it means all forms of cigars. So flavor cigars comprised 79% of the market in 2014. And menthol comprises 3.2% of those sales. So with the advent of legislation that's prohibiting flavors, there is a good chance that cigar use will diminish over the next couple of years, though menthol is still allowed. So we see here it's 3.2% of all cigar sales. It'll be really interesting to see what happens to people that have smoked other flavors. Will they quit altogether? Will they jump onto the menthol bandwagon? Or will they just go on to a regular cigarillo? And there's still some flavors allowed, that is rum and wine. Kind of the alcohol-type-inspired flavors are still allowed, and menthol, of course. So it's going to be interesting in the next couple of years to see what happens. Cigarette smoking, past 30-day use, is 16.1%. So this has the definition of have you smoked in the past 30 days, and have you smoked 100 cigarettes in a lifetime, which is about 4 packs of cigarettes. So it's not, you know, it's not a burdensome definition. 4 packs of cigarettes can go through pretty quick, particularly, you know, most daily smokers smoke, anywhere from 10 to 15 cigarettes a day. So that's, you know, in 4 or 5 days, you're going to have your 4 packs if you're a daily smoker. So we see this is 12 years and over, current smoking. We see that it has gone down from 2010, 5 years ago, from 8.2% to 16.1%. So this next chart, it has that information. If we look at the very, very end, 2014, it has the 16% here. This is trend data, though, from 2001 right through. So we see there has been significant progress, and as we just pointed out, the number at 2010, which 2010 is a benchmark year. So in this report, unlike other previous reports, we've established benchmark or comparison years. And so we've done that for methodological statistical reasons. And the years that we're using is the year before. So if we're looking at 2014, like, was there a significant change from the year before? Or we're picking 2010, a 5-year point, and that's kind of somewhat arbitrary, 5 years. But we just established a 5-year point, and anytime we're looking at significance, we're not looking at years 11 and 12, we're looking at 2010. And that's just to protect us from calling something that's significant that's not really significant. We also use a benchmark year sometimes of 2005, which is kind of just, you know, leading into the implementation of the SFO. So 19 plus, the other thing we've done in this report in the tobacco use chapter is we've looked at things, we've looked at the indicators by 12 years and over and by 19 years and over. For 19 years and over, we do see a significant change from 2010 to 2014, as shown here. So this has this is a combination of the first chart we saw, 12 years and over, which is the green, and the purple is 19 years and over. So there's not much difference between the two. We can see that when you only include the sample of people that are 19 years and over, there's, you know, more smokers. They're adults. They're more likely to smoke than if you include the whole population. So here's past 30-day current smoking by 12 years and over, and this is by health unit. So we see we're at a low from Peel at around 11% to a high at Temiskaming at around 29%, and then all the way through as well. So this is a 2-year sample, so it's fairly robust. So we can see that there's several health units up front that have a low smoking prevalence, and there's a number that have a significant high prevalence, typically in the northern part of the province. And we see the very last column there is Ontario at 16%, which is almost half of you know, the highest rate in the province. Current smoking by occupation. So this is restricted to 15 to 75-year-olds. So we see there's a number of occupations that have a high smoking rate. So we're looking at processing, manufacturing, utilities at 33%, just above that, primary industry at 29%. The very, very last bar is trade, transport, equipment operators at 32%. So one thing in common with all these, they're all blue-collar workers for the most part, right? Blue-collar occupations. And that's in contrast to some of the lower smoking rates out there. Social science, education, government services, religion, 9%. Natural and applied science is 9%. So we see this kind of white-collar, blue-collar divide. And this is telling you, for smoking cessation, blue-collars are an ideal group to target. They have a significantly higher rate of smoking than other occupations, and there's a fair chunk of them too, right? So they meet both standards. There's they have a high rate, and there's a significant number of blue collar occupations in there, in the population. So in our report, we try to not only present the prevalence numbers, but we try to present the actual number of people that is represented. So in the report, we have that as an example. Just a note, with respect to the questions, we'll stop here in a few minutes and we'll go through and we'll answer some of these questions. So by all means, keep asking the questions. So just as a note, the M's in these bar charts, that means it's a marginal estimate, and that means just statistically interpret with caution. Sometimes they're flagged with an S, and that means they're totally suppressed, and we don't show the information. And it's due to sample size is low, or something called the coefficient of variation is high. So if it's flagged with M, just interpret with caution. There could be some variability in that number from year to year. So if it says 9%, it could be, it could, in other years you may look at it maybe 5% or maybe 15%. It may jump around because of the small sample size. This year it's not as precise as a number that doesn't have an M on it. Education 18 plus. So here we have a high of 30% for those with less than high school education, and a low of 8% if you have a university education. The numbers in the brackets at the end there, that's the number of people that, for instance, less than people that have less than high school education. 30% of those people smoke, and that 30% represents 239,000, 240,000 people. Those are smokers. So we see that that's a high prevalence, and there's a significant number of people there as well. So if you were going to target less than high school versus university, university has this very similar number of people, but less than high school has huge rate of smoking. You look at someone like post-secondary, they have half the rate of smoking at 15%, but there's twice the number of smokers in that category. So it can get a little complicated in terms of who to target, but it's useful to look at both pieces of information, the prevalence and the numbers they represent. So this is the same, the very last column is 2014, which is what we just saw, the same numbers. This is over time, though. So we see that it's been fairly consistent over time. University degree, significantly less rates of smoking, less than high school. The top bar, purple, significantly more rates of smoking. It's been fairly consistent over time, not a lot of change. So we're going to take a quick break here and see if folks have any questions. So,
yeah. So we do have a few questions. I just like to note that we're going to focus on the questions right now relating to what Sean has been discussing, and then we'll focus on more broad questions after. We want to make sure we have enough time to get through the material that we want to present today. So we have a question. Can the report be ordered from OTRU?
The report is available free of charge on our website. It can be downloaded. This year we've also presented it differently, so you can download the full report, you can download the executive summary, and you can download each of the chapters separately. We no longer actually print the report, so you're free to print it out for yourself. If you're interested in wider distribution in terms of numbers, then please do get in touch with us directly, and we will figure something out.
Thanks very much, Rob. We have a comment from Rochelle. She says, I would like to note that Temiskaming's rate looks overinflated, as we have a small population and typically data needs to be combined over a few years for more stable numbers. I don't know if you want to comment on that, Sean.
Yeah. Well, it's true. There is a small rate of population there. The CCHS typically, for their health unit and level analysis, they recommend that you combine 2 years of data, and I think that chart that we presented did have 2013-2014 combined data, and I don't specifically recall if that was flagged. Flagged with an M, but it's the highest for 2013-14. If you look at the previous years, it'll be in the top five. No doubt.
Right, and just to note, all of the health units, because of the small sample size, the rates do change. They jump up and down, not in a small amount from year to year.
Yeah.
So the comment is well taken. It's a good point. that these specific percentages for each health unit should be taken with a bit of a grain of salt.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is the CCHS does, I think the sample is 1,000 per health unit. So irrespective of which health unit it is, they go and sample 1,000 across that two-year period.
Perfect. Thanks very much, Sean. We have a question about education, the amount of current smokers versus the amount of current smokers that were added up when you put the number of smokers there. Somebody just had a question about where the other current smokers are.
So is this with respect to the education chart?
Yes.
All right, let's just... So, yeah, this data is from CAMH Monitor and includes 18 plus. So, you know, there's typically, you know, there's a few million smokers in the province. And you'll get different numbers on different data sources. You'll get different numbers depending on which ages you look at. So we're looking at, for this chart, 18 years and over. If we were looking at 12 years and over, there'd be a number of other smokers. If we were looking at a different survey too, there could be a slightly different number.
Right, and just we estimate that there are around 2 million people smokers in Ontario, not three.
Yeah, definitely not three. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's like 1.9 to 2.1 million. You know.
Perfect. We have a question. People talk about growing social disparities in smoking. Do these data show this?
I don't know if it shows growing disparities, but it does show disparities. So I'm not sure what definition of disparities you're using, but we do see that smoking does not smoking is not equal amongst different social groups or different groups in the province. As we showed here, blue-collar workers have a much higher rate of smoking. People with lower education have a much higher rate of smoking. Young adults have a much higher rate of smoking. Male young adults have a much higher rate of smoking. So, you know, this smoking does not affect all these subpopulations equally.
So I think, Jennifer, also, just the data isn't good enough to get a good handle on this. We only have disparities by education and by occupation, basically, in the data that we're showing. And the general trends over fairly long periods of time in both of these don't indicate that there is growing disparity. But I think that's to be taken with a grain of salt. We wouldn't venture to use these data to give a full-fledged answer to that question.
Yeah, if you know, the report does have a little bit of additional information. You know, it may report on some additional groups. Basically what you're saying, I mean, basically to the extent that these lines are different shows there's disparity amongst these groups. So this education, for instance, so, you know, like I say, university degree is much lower than everything else. To the extent that the gap, you know, in 2003, the gap between the two lines is higher than the gap in 2014, I would suggest that there's a change in disparity over time, and we haven't looked at that specifically, but you can kind of eyeball these charts and take a look to see if there is an interaction. That is, are the lines crossing each other or approaching each other, which would suggest over time that there are disparities growing or lessening or growing.
We have a question. Do you think the use of smokeless tobacco among youth is underreported?
There has been suggestions by people in the field that it is underreported. I my sense is that it's typically not underreported, and I see that. I mean, I guess it's a matter of opinion. I know the numbers have been consistent year over year over year, that they're quite low. And I know that other people think that it can be a huge problem with some jurisdictions. I would think on the balance, though, that these numbers are fairly accurate. And one difference might be is that the numbers presented kind of take the long-term perspective. They ask everybody over like a, you know, kind of a year type of thing. Whereas if you're sitting in a health unit looking at a, you know, looking at a high school in March, you may see, you know, two-thirds of the guys in one classroom smoking, smokeless tobacco.
Yes.
But when you average that across all the males in that school, including the females, including not just that month in March, but you're looking at September and October as well, it seems that it averages out to what we presented here. The thing there, too, is that I'm not sure if I presented this yet. If it's not yet, it's coming up, that the use among youth it's like 6-7%, but people only try it a few times, right? They don't go on to smoke it every day or don't use the product every day. They try it once or twice and quit.
Thanks, Sean. We have another question. I'm just going to do two more questions and then we'll move on. We want to make sure we can cover all of the material. There's a question about the focus on higher percentage prevalence rates, especially in the less than high school category. There are larger numbers of smokers in the higher education cohorts. If we want a larger number of quits, shouldn't we be looking after those larger cohorts, especially the some post-secondary group?
Yeah, I mean, in general, yeah, you're right. I mean, one has to take, I'm thinking like from a comprehensive tobacco control program, you need to take both perspectives. You need to take kind of a clinical perspective, and you need to take a population level perspective. You can't achieve those goals that I laid out in the beginning, like to have the lowest smoking rate in Canada or 5% in 5 years by going after a clinical perspective. You can't just treat, you know, 20, 30, 50, 100,000 smokers. You got to treat, you know, 2.1 million smokers. You have to address or get 2.1 million smokers to quit if you want a population level perspective. So both perspectives can be correct, but from a population perspective, you do need to reach, you know, you do need to reach those 2 million smokers.
Okay. Now we do have a couple of questions that are about some topics that we aren't necessarily highlighting today, but that I believe would be in the monitoring report.
Yes.
Some of them are, what are the particular demographic traits in the communities that have high smoking rates, or what are the trends for daily versus non-daily smoking and heaviness of smoking, and new data regarding the smoking rates in Aboriginal populations?
Right. Well, the report does have information on daily, non-daily smoking, daily and occasional smoking, and it does have information on heaviness of smoking. I know heaviness of smoking is remained stable over time. Daily smoking, about, you know, 80-85% plus or minus 2 or 3% are daily smokers. Something like 88% are daily smokers. And those charts are in the monitoring report. Aboriginal, it's tough to get information on very small subpopulations like the LGBT groups, Aboriginal, and other populations. So unfortunately, we don't do as good a job as we'd like on those populations. We just can't find the surveillance data at the provincial level.
Okay. And we just had one last question regarding that. Do you happen to know if Aboriginal or Indigenous populations are included in these rates?
To the extent that it's different by different survey, to the extent that the survey asks Aboriginals, their smoking rate, they'll be included. At the back of the report, in an appendix, we have some descriptions of the surveys and what they include and what they don't conclude. And so, if you know for sure, if anybody's in a community, if anybody's in municipalities, rural, urban, they'll get asked these questions. For some of the surveys, if you're on reserve, you may not get asked. But it depends on the survey, and I'd refer people to the appendix that describes that more fully.
Okay, perfect. Thanks, everyone, for your questions. If we didn't have a chance to answer your question during this question period, we'll get to it at the end of the webinar.
Okay, so the third chapter is prevention. And so we're going to go through this quickly, and we're going to turn it over to Rob afterwards. So some of the questions you folks had will be answered in this section. So does smoking increase gradually with age, or does the rate jump? So that's kind of that's one question that we'll see if we can address with some of these data. So lifetime absence, this is never having smoked a puff on a cigarette, and we see here that it ranges from grade 7 at 98%, so basically grade, you know, no one in grade 7 smoking. Grade 8, 93%. No one in grade 8 or very few people in grade 8 have ever tried cigarettes. We see in grade 9, though, 11% have tried a cigarette. Grade 10, 80% have never tried, which means 20% have, going up to right up to 69, and 68% is lifetime abstinence. So one interesting kind of note about this is that other research that OTRU has conducted suggests that if you ever try a cigarette, you've got like a, you know, two-thirds chance, like, you know, like a something like a 70% chance of going on to become a daily smoker. So if you ever try a cigarette, you know, 70% of you are going to become a daily smoker. So if you look at these numbers, to the extent that these aren't 100%, those people have a good chance of becoming a daily smoker. And as we'll see, yeah, this is the same chart. This is over time. So we see there has been improvements over time, particularly when you look at, you know, like 2003, 2005. So the trend is positive. Last couple of years, though, it has been quite stable. Past year smoking, not reportable for grade 7 and 8. It's too small a number. For grade 9, though, we have 8% of people have tried smoking in the past year. And this past year would be, you know, you'd be, so for instance, if this survey was in the spring, you'd be in grade 9 and in probably the latter stages of grade 8 type of thing. For grade 10, 16% have smoked in the past year, going up to 21% and 24% as you get into those higher grades. So again, you know, if you've ever tried smoking, 70% of you are going to go on to become a daily smoker. So this is highly significant. This is the same chart, except this is over time. So we see, you know, past year smoking has declined over time. It has been relatively stable for the last 3 or 4 years, though. Again, age is across the bottom. The prevalence or the rate of smoking is up the side. Current smoking past 30 days. We do see that there is a jump here. There's been a jump. Kind of, you see this jump kind of from grade 9, 10 to 11 and 12 in most of these indicators. And this is demonstrated here by this chart. And we just, I don't know if I have a slide in this, but, you know, as I mentioned, if you ever try a cigarette, you got about a 70% chance of becoming a daily smoker. And you're going to become a daily smoker within about a year and a half. You know, you get nicotine into your system, but a year and a half later, you're a daily smoker. So here's current smoking. This is Canadian Community Health Survey. So we've got a few more ages to deal to report. So again, we see that, you know, youth 15 to 17 have a very low rate of smoking, 3%, and it's marginal. It's interpreted with caution because it's so low. 18 to 19-year-olds jumped up to 10. 20, 24-year-olds jumps up to 17. I'm looking at the very last column here, or last data points for 2014, and 25 to 29-year-olds at 23%. You know, there is a slight decline over time. If you look at 2003, 2005, we do see a slight decline, particularly amongst the youth and young adults. Are emerging products an issue? So we got another poll for you. So here's the question. Which product has the higher rate of past year use amongst grade 7 to 12-year-old, grade 7 to 12 students in Ontario? So these grade 7 to 12 students in Ontario, which product has the highest past year use? The just The 70%, responding to kind of a question here, the 70% that have ever tried a cigarette that go on to become daily smokers, that's based on an analysis of Canadian Community Health Survey data. So we're just waiting here. We've got a number of respondents answering. We'll give it a few more seconds. I think I didn't actually see the distribution of responses, but I think e-cigarettes may have been the highest. Was it? Yeah. But it was fairly close. It was 51 to 38, like that. So, oh, yeah, so the percent there, yeah, sorry. So, yeah, 54% said e-cigarettes, 40% said cigarettes, 5% said water pipe. So about half of you are quite knowledgeable. So we'll just switch to the this chart here. So pasture use, the last column, 19% of youth in grades 7 to 12, 2 and 10 have tried e-cigarettes in the past year. That's higher than cigarettes. So that's quite amazing, given that this product wasn't even around a couple years ago. And water pipe is quite high too, at 12%. And we see every use is higher than that. Not a lot higher, because, again, these are youth, so they don't have a lot of years of trying out these products. And the other thing is e-cigarettes and water pipe have only been around for a few years. So one important note, e-cigarette use is higher than everything, but you have to recall that if you ask people how many times they tried these products, cigarettes would be much more frequent behavior, right? So cigarettes look slower here, but just a caution, cigarette use would be much more commonly used, like as in frequency. So e-cigarette use, grade 7 to 12, again, 23%. It's 27% for males, 18% for females. So there is a, you know, it looks like there's a spread there, but again, it's high for both. For both genders. Water pipe use, lifetime, 14% among students in grades 7 to 12, but look at that, 26% in grade 12. Part of that may be access. Grade 12s have greater access to water pipe. And we've reported this last number before, 18% among 15 years and older. So water pipe use and e-cigarette use are really, really strong amongst youth and young adults, much more so than the whole population. Smokeless tobacco. So I referred to this earlier. So this is OSDS, grade 7 to 12. 6.3% of students have tried in the past year. And this is the caveat that I mentioned. Among these users, 78% tried just a few times. So they try it, and it'll continue with it. Now, with the flavor ban is going to affect this product as well. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to the prevalence of this product. Will people quit this altogether? Will they switch to menthol or some other rum and wine type of products? We don't know. But it's something that's going to be interesting for us over the next couple of years. So in the reports, we get into the Scientific Advisory Committee recommendations and the NPower recommendations as well. We're going to just briefly look at a few of these here before we turn it over to Rob. So first one, target interventions to schools, colleges, universities, and workplaces where youth and young adults are at greatest risk. We need to align cessation and prevention programs. We need to increase media and social marketing. As mentioned, it hasn't really been intensive or ongoing in the province. So we'll break here for questions, if there's any, and then we'll flip it over to Rob.
Yeah, we have some questions here. You mentioned earlier youth who have ever tried a cigarette are 70% more likely to go on to become regular tobacco users. Is this the same for ever trying an e-cigarette?
So I can address that. The data that we have so far about e-cigarettes suggests that many people try them once and then do not continue. The question is, though, a little bit complicated because we don't know if people are using nicotine in those e-cigarettes or not. Nicotine is not legal in Canada in e-cigarettes. However, at least half, or around half, we figure from the data that we have of e-cigarettes that are being used do contain nicotine. But containing nicotine can mean various things, and it really depends on how much nicotine and what the delivery of that nicotine is. We still don't know a whole lot about the addictiveness of nicotine that's vaped into lungs in various concentrations. So generally speaking, the answer to the question is probably not, but there's so much to be learned.
Yep.
And we have another question before we move on. What do you mean by a lining prevention and cessation program?
Well, I guess there's from a prevention perspective, there's a couple of different perspectives in prevention. One is to prevent people from ever trying a first cigarette, which is a great prevention strategy, right? Because we know that if you try that first cigarette, chances are you're going to become a daily smoker. So there's a prevention from that perspective. There's also prevention from kind of a de-escalation of cigarette use, right? So you want to discourage the continued uptake of cigarette use. And to that extent, it's similar to cessation in a sense that they've tried cigarettes. They may not be a daily smoker yet, but you want to de-escalate that behavior. And so at the top level of prevention, it kind of gets into the bottom level of cessation.
Perfect. Thanks, Sean. And we just have one more question before we move on. Is there any data on the use of cannabis in e-cigarettes or water pipes?
Yeah, we haven't reported any information in this monitoring report. There are ongoing efforts to include these questions on surveillance tools. As you can imagine, e-cigarettes just kind of came on the market over the last couple of years. We became aware of them, as in tobacco control became aware of them over the last couple of years. So we got, you know, a limited space on surveys. We got some questions on, like, are you using e-cigarettes? Now that we have those questions on, we have to go in and ask, okay, well, what kind of e-cigarettes are you using? Are you using cannabis on those e-cigarettes? So, unfortunately, it takes many years for some of these questions to get on and it takes a year or so afterwards they're on to collect the data and then a year to analyze the data. So we're not there yet, but we recognize that this is a need, and there are some tools out there that are starting to address this. So maybe next year.
And just one more clarifying question before we move on. When you were talking about the 70%, are people who ever try a cigarette 70% more likely to become a daily smoker, or do 70% of those who ever try a cigarette become a daily smoker?
The latter. So if you try a cigarette, so if a group of people try a cigarette, 70% of that group will go on to become a daily smoker. And whether it's, you know, we looked at 70%, I know we've looked at some other people analyzing different data, and, you know, they get 65%. So, you know, 60, 70%, two-thirds of people.
Perfect. Thanks very much. Rob?
Okay, thank you. How are we all doing? It's a lot of data, a lot of information. And just before I get into the cessation chapter, I just wanted to note something about the question that we pose in our title. How well are we doing? And, you know, that's a really difficult question to ask a scientist because it really is a normative question. How well are we doing? Well, you know, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. If you asked me 10 years ago when I started in tobacco control if I thought that in 2016 we were still going to have one-fifth of the people in this province using tobacco products, I would have hoped not. Okay, but we still do have one-fifth of people using tobacco products. Does that mean we're not doing well? Well, we are moving. Undoubtedly, we are moving. So that's just the thinking that guides me as I go through some more of the data that's in the report. And once again, we're only presenting part of the data. There's lots more for those of you who are interested in looking at the report itself. So is there any need for an increase in price or tax? This is one of the key questions that we have. The SAC recommendation, the Scientific Advisory Committee recommendation, was to implement a substantial increase in provincial tobacco taxes. Taxes are one of the key, most effective ways to decrease tobacco use. It is well proven, both from Canadian data and from international data. And we have recommendations to triple the price of tobacco in order to bring about a significant decline. Countries that have tried this, for example, France, have had quite a lot of success. And right now, Ontario still has the second lowest price of tobacco in Canada. You see in this chart that Quebec has the lowest. The graph is just a cumulative graph, so we added on each of the bars adds on a little bit more that each of the provinces brings. So you see that the difference between the high price in Manitoba, $133, and the low price in Ontario at $93 is really substantial. I'll say a word about contraband because inevitably people are going to ask about contraband. And I'm going to refer you to an article that we published recently in the Canadian Medical Association Journal called Debunking the Tax Contraband Myth. Please read that article if you think that raising taxes is going to cause a substantial increase in contraband. It is not. Okay, look at the article. So this is where we are with taxes. It's very clear that taxation will cause increases in cessation and decreases in initiation, well proven with many, many studies. How are we doing with quitting behavior? We're certainly investing more. There's more programs that the Ministry of Health is supporting to help smokers quit. But what impact is that actually having on quitting behavior? Well, I could have just, 10 years ago, I think, presented the same slide because there isn't any change in intentions to quit. On the one hand, intentions to quit look pretty high. So for those who are intending to quit, the question is, do you intend to quit smoking tobacco cigarettes in the next 6 months? We've got 60% of smokers. So we know that almost all smokers want to quit. 60% want to quit in the next 6 months. That's pretty soon. That's pretty impressive. But the problem is that it hasn't really changed over the course of time. 64% said that they would do so in 2002. When you look at 30-day intentions to quit, it's a similar story. It hasn't changed much. We've got a little bit of jump between 2013 and 2014. But as you see, the confidence intervals are quite large here, so that's not statistically significant. Hopefully, with time, we will see an increase here. Maybe this is signifying some potential change in intentions to quit in the next 30 days. But still, it's only about a quarter of smokers to 30% of smokers who are interested or intending to quit in the next 30 days. If you don't intend to quit, not much chance that it's going to happen. Quit attempts is really the a key measure that we use to indicate whether a successful quits will happen. We know that the more quit attempts, that it takes, from our data, it takes on average about 30 quit attempts in order to actually succeed to quit. So we want people to make more quit attempts. And we also want those quit attempts to be more successful, but here we see that there has not been any significant change in the number of quit attempts that people make in the course of a year. So there are about 40% of our smokers are making one or more quit attempts in a year. So, you know, on one hand, that sounds pretty good. On the other hand, we know that many more quit attempts need to be made in order to achieve successful quits and decrease in prevalence. So here's a polling question. What is the percentage of previous year smokers who quit and remain smoke-free for the subsequent 12 months? Okay, so is it 2%, 5%, 8%, or 10%? Again, previous year smokers who quit and then remain quit, so don't relapse to smoking over the course of 12 months. See if the numbers are coming in quickly. Okay, so we have 91 responses, and here's how they break down. So the majority, 43%, said that only 2% of smokers, of such smokers, would remain quit for 12 months. Then you can see the rest. So it actually is the majority who think that more smokers will remain quit for those 12 months. The actual numbers are a little bit different. So about 7.9% of past year smokers do quit for 30 days or longer. However, relapse is about 79%. So our calculations show that 1.7%, so even less than 2%, of previous year smokers who quit and remain smoke-free for the subsequent 12 months. So that's a rather frustrating proportion. We see that that hasn't changed significantly over time. Because of this relapse, we need more quit attempts, more successful quits, and probably more attention to relapse prevention. What is our scientific advisory committee? And this was a report from 5 years ago now, as information. We are convened once again as a scientific advisory committee, and over the next year we will have a new report with the latest and greatest evidence. But according to those recommendations 5 years ago, we need a tobacco user support system where any smoker can enter the system from anywhere. More direct support, so integrating free NRT and behavioral support, and accountability mechanisms. Making sure that healthcare providers are held accountable for doing the 3 A's or the 5 A's, however you want to count them, making sure that healthcare providers are held accountable for addressing the tobacco disease of their patients. Furthermore, to systemize and expand the evidence-based policy services and supports to target high-risk subpopulations, to innovate in workplaces, community colleges, community-based organizations, etc., sustained, intensive, and integrated mass media, and then once again that point about aligning cessation and prevention programs. We are going to pause there now for questions about the cessation chapter.
Okay, we have some questions. Do you see on the trend that the intent of quit attempts rises with the raise of taxes?
So it's hard to say anything about that in Ontario since we haven't had a real tax increase in many years. We did have a 5% increase, I think it was 2 years ago now, but that 5% increase was only actually really bringing us back to where we should have been, because inflation had eroded the actual price of cigarettes over time. What we do see in the international data is actual decreases in the prevalence of smoking when taxes increase. So one would expect that intentions to quit would also increase with substantial tax increases that we haven't seen in Ontario.
Perfect. Thanks, Rob. We have a comment about the tax chart that you showed. I believe the per carton prices you're quoting are for premium brands. However, latest data shows that potentially two-thirds of the market is made out of discount products. We currently have no controls for the prices that the industry sets for its various products. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, so the in terms of the taxation, we have in the Monitor Report, we have a chart that I refer people to, and it discusses the average pre-tax price of the product for across the jurisdictions, the provinces and territories, and that's from the Consumer Price Index. And then it goes out and lays out, it goes on to talk about the federal excise duty, the excise tax from provinces and territories, and this harmonized sales tax, and the federal GST, the total tobacco taxes, so you can really get a good sense. And to the extent that that average price is, whether it's discount or not, the reality is that it provides a base for each of the provinces. So if each, you know, the Consumer Price Index is going in, and whether it's looking at premium cigarettes or discount cigarettes, it's the same for each of the provinces.
Right, and discount is a problem because discount actually does diminish from the effectiveness of tax as a price, as a tool to increase price. Undoubtedly, and more forward-looking policies on tobacco prices actually take into account price controls that would look at requiring minimum prices for cigarettes and perhaps eliminating the discount market.
Thanks very much. Do we know what is considered a substantial what is considered substantial for tax increases?
It's a good question. As I said, a recent article in the in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, published by my colleague Prabhat Jha and by Richard Pito, recommends tripling the price of cigarettes, or rather tripling the taxes in order to double the price of cigarettes. So that would be substantial. In other countries, in New Zealand, for example, they have, for 3 years running, they increase each year the tax by 10% in that.
And we just have one more question on this topic. Why isn't the provincial government raising taxes on cigarettes? What's holding them back?
Well, I can't, from a scientist perspective, actually answer that question well. Michael Purley, who's been active in answering questions, might venture a response. What I hear is that there is still fear of contraband, but I don't know that is the answer or the full answer. And I think there is some hope that we may see a price increase soon.
And one more question before we move on. Are there new strategies being looked at with regard to relapse and support to clients coming back for support after relapse? I don't know if this is part of the report, but do you have a comment?
I don't know for sure. I know that the largest cessation providers, that being STOP, Smokers Helpline, and Ottawa Heart, have a great interest in the question of relapse. And they, together with us, have proposed some research that would actually look at long-term engagement with smokers in different ways in order to help prevent relapse. I don't know for certain whether the ministry or any of the key cessation providers are actually engaging in work today that is much different in order to engage smokers over the long term.
And just to note too, and this goes back and addresses another question about, you know, how do you reach men and blue collar workers who consult medical services less than other populations? And I mentioned this before that there's kind of a clinical approach and there's population level approaches, and to reach the goals that the strategy has for itself, you have to have a population level perspective. So, you know, STOP and Leave the Pack Behind and the Ottawa model, they all do great work. They're all basically clinical services, or they deal with small portions of the population. They don't deal with the entire population, and they're not going to be able to reach those 2 million smokers. So we have to come up with methods that are going to get those 2 million smokers to quit, and to quit more often. And so, in addition to the clinical work, and to do that, mass media is going to get them thinking about quitting. Taxation is going to get them thinking about quitting, and there's another population level perspectives.
There's another comment just along that vein before we move along. Somebody mentioned about policies like plain packaging that would try to fight marketing, which is probably very effective on young people and population.
Right. So things like plain packaging and decreasing retail density are examples of additional measures that we actually didn't bring in this chapter. They are recommended elsewhere in the Scientific Advisory Committee report. Also, we now have an endgame initiative for Canada underway, which is discussing many other measures, many of them focused on the industry or the supply side, which undoubtedly would affect both cessation and prevention.
Okay, perfect. I think we're good to move on.
Great. Okay. And I see that time is running, so let's plow forward and get into protection. And the question here is protection done? Are we finished with protection? Well, we've made great strides. This is really something to commend the province and many municipalities supported by health units to get bylaws and policies passed. There's still some frustration, as you can see, for example, in this chart, exposure at work to secondhand smoke has decreased, but only slightly over time. And we still have 9% of people who work, smokers who work, exposed to secondhand smoke in the past week in the workplace. That can be indoors or in a work vehicle. This is kind of shocking when you consider all of the measures that we have in place. Clearly, more work needs to be done to protect people from secondhand smoke. Just to mention quickly, the Surgeon General has made very clear that there is no safe level of exposure to secondhand smoke. Public place exposure by non-smokers every day or almost every day. Look at this. 25% of youth are exposed every day or almost every day to secondhand smoke in public places. That is shocking. And 15% of people age 12 and above are exposed to secondhand smoke every day or almost every day. Now, I would have to answer yes to this question because I walk from my office to this office, for example, at the Canadian at Cancer Care Ontario, and on the way, I'm inevitably exposed to secondhand smoke. So clearly, protection is not done. We have a law in place in Ontario that bans smoking in vehicles where there are children under the age of 15. Nevertheless, still in 2014, 5% of kids between the ages of 12 and 15 were exposed to secondhand smoke in vehicles. This is the first time we actually analyzed the data for that age group specifically. In this chart, you can see that there have been, since 2007, for example, 16% were down to 5% now for age 12 to 15. The exposure of adults, or those over the age of 12, I should say, is fairly constant and is at about at the same rate. So here's, I think, your last polling question for the day. Are non-smoking youth aged 12 to 18 exposed to secondhand smoke at home to the same level as the non-smoking population 12 years and older? So in other words, are kids exposed to secondhand smoke at home more than the general population? Or is it at the same level, at a lower level, or at a higher level? All right, this is for non-smokers only. right. Bump, 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 bump. Give it another 10 seconds, eh? You guys are a bit slower on this question, so maybe you're tired.
Tricky question.
After all of this time on the webinar. We've got 15 minutes of time left in this webinar, and I think we should just about be on time. So we're going to go to the results now, and we see that the majority, 57%, think that kids are exposed at a higher level than the general population, and that is correct. So we see that 8% of kids between the ages of 12 and 18 were exposed at home every day or almost every day to secondhand smoke, and only 3% of the general population. I was thinking about these numbers a little bit before and wondering how much of that is due to older people. And if we cut out people, say, 60 and above, how much difference we would see. So we're going to do some more analysis on this. The SAC recommendations regarding protection were as follows: compliance and enforcement, broaden protections in the Smoke-Free Ontario Act. A lot of that has been done. More media and social marketing about protection, facilitate grassroots local action, social norm change, support a learning system. Okay, so these are the overall conclusions of the report. So we're moving out of protection and into a general discussion now with 14 minutes left in our time. So I'm going to do this fairly quickly so that we can address some more questions. So Empower, those minimum standards set by through the FCTC and the World Health Organization, Ontario has done most, but not all of them, but there are several scientific advisory recommendations that remain, unfortunately, unfulfilled. Some of the main conclusions: there's a downward trend for youth, and we may well see that there are positive trends in this in the coming years. I did want to add one thing about the general trend, which is that, we often have an impression that tobacco is done. It's talked about a lot. And then, you know, for many of us in our social circles, we barely find anybody who's smoking. So it does give a general sense that, we've made great progress and that there isn't a whole lot more to do. And looking back over the past 20 years, we see that adult tobacco use has decreased from 25% in 1996 to 18% in 2014. Well, that sounds like progress. The question is, though, that given what is known about tobacco-caused morbidity and mortality, this rate of decline would be viewed by many as unsatisfactory. In some occupations, we have still one in every three people smoking. And with one in every five adult Ontarians currently using tobacco, it is clear that tobacco is far from done. So that is another general conclusion. In cessation, reach still remains a concern, even though we have had gains in how many people are being reached by clinical programs. In our population programs, we see that it's still only a small proportion of smokers who are being reached. In protection, we've had strong progress, but what we just presented here indicates that there's still a way to go to protect people in general, and particularly youth. We're going to end it there. And just to say again that we don't want to give an impression that there has not been progress. Statistically significant decline, 2 percentage points in the past 5 years. You know, that's some encouragement there. We haven't seen that kind of significant decline over the past couple of years. So that was a nice thing to see. Rates for youth are really way down. For young adults, they are down significantly as well. And we do see also, with some of the new measures that were put in place in the past year regarding flavors, regarding protection, so the ban on patios. You know, Ontario is certainly taking great strides, and nevertheless, it's our duty to present the hard data that in some places still leaves us more than a little bit frustrated. So I'm going to move over to questions now.
So I'll just say that the report is online on our homepage. It can be downloaded in its entirety. The exec summary, which is a four-page exec sum, can be reviewed, and also each chapter is separate and can be downloaded if you're just interested in one of the chapters, for instance. The other thing of note for this report is that a lot of the charts that are presented, the data, can be linked to TIMS. So at the bottom of the chart under the source, I think it says, click here to link to the data. And you can click that and be ported into a TIMS session, which will present the data that is in the chart. It may not look exactly like the chart, but it'll, with a few clicks of the TIMS system, you can make it look like the chart that's in the report. You can also go back and look at different parameters for that chart. So if it is a chart of 12 years and over and you want to go look at 19 years and over, you can just go in and look and switch the age and look at it. And you can do that for jurisdictions and age, sex, and so forth.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Sean. We have some questions here. In the slide when you were talking about secondhand smoke exposure in public places, how were indoor and outdoor places identified?
That's all public places.
We have a question here. Are we going to see more of a problem with tobacco in young people if marijuana is legalized?
We don't know. I don't know there's any reason to suggest that. There is a question about people smoking marijuana together with tobacco. And I think we really don't know enough about that. Also, my hope would be that if and when marijuana is legalized, that the smoked type of marijuana would not be legalized, because we know that smoking anything has really deleterious health effects. So hopefully we will not have legalized smoked marijuana, and therefore the likelihood of that measure bringing about more smoked tobacco use is probably low.
Perfect.
Just with respect to the exposure in public places, the question asks, have you been exposed every day or almost every day in public places? And I believe it gives examples, restaurants, bars, shopping malls, arenas. So it's left to the person filling in the survey, the respondent, to gauge what a public place is.
We have a comment here from Smokers Helpline that their new first week challenge contest is promoting monthly quit attempts. So
great.
Along with
great.
The theme.
Yeah, that's great, because we saw from our data, in terms of quit intentions, were, past 30-day quit intentions were something like 25 or 30%. And we saw, past year quit attempts were, they were 40, 45, 47% or something like that. And from a population level perspective, if you want to reach, the numbers that we have as goals, you need to get, at least half of all smokers need to, have quit attempts and you need to reach much more people. So an initiative that increases the number of people that are quitting and the frequency with which they are quitting are highly valued.
We have a question here. Over the years, due to the large progress we've seen, is it more due to people not starting smoking or people stopping smoking, especially when we look at the less than 2% of people stopping and remaining a non-smoker?
Over the long term, so if we go back to the 1980s or the 1990s and we compare rates of smoking then to now, it would seem that there has been a substantial decrease. It would be a combination of both decreased initiation and increased cessation. Likely, the initiation has the decrease in initiation, which has long-term effects rather than immediate effects, would have accounted for a fair bit of that. It's a good question, and I think it's something that we can put our analytical tools to trying to figure out more.
In terms of a smoking prevalence of, say, like 16% in the province, and if you want to impact that, you have to get people to quit because it's a numbers game. Because, you know, there's 2 million smokers type of thing, but the people that are initiating, that are coming in, relative to the amount of smokers that are out there, there's very small. So, I mean, prevention is a value component to a comprehensive tobacco control. You have to have it. It won't really change the smoking rate in the short term because there's so many smokers that are, you know, that aren't in that prevention phase. They're there, right? So it's kind of a numbers game. And the other thing too is that, you know, it could be explained by kind of natural kind of consequences. It could be explained by tobacco control, but don't forget it can also be explained by tobacco industry. They haven't stopped their marketing promotion. They want people to smoke. They don't want people to quit. And, you know, they've been going at it for, you know, decades and decades and decades. And even with all this legislation that's come forward over the last 10 years, they're still at it.
I think that's a good segue. Michael Perley, Rob, you had welcomed him to share a little bit regarding taxes. And we can see here that Michael did make a comment about raising taxes, that the industry has had an extremely active campaign to convince legislators that contraband is directly tied with increased prices via greater taxation. While this can be rebutted by both research and analysis of the defects in the industry statements, the industry has been able to establish the tax increase contraband argument by simple repetition over and over to legislators. This has worked to a considerable extent because there has been a real contraband problem. It's just not as large, serious, or as difficult to control as the industry says that it is. So that was just to the comments of why the province hasn't raised the taxes. And mm-hmm. as Rob mentioned, there is a paper on that, exactly what Michael was talking about, and the research behind rebutting that argument.
Yeah, just like in the last month, you know, the Ontario Convenience Store Association has met with the government, you know, requested meetings and have had meetings with the government over issues including price and tax.
There's a question related to that, and I don't know how well you'll be able to answer, but feel free to comment. Would increase in taxes influence youth to seek other recreational drugs at the same cost?
I mean, the reason taxation works is something called the price elasticity of demand. It means if you increase the price, demand will fall. So the reality is, you know, if you increase the price, youth are more sensitive, so they're going to quit at a higher rate than adults. They're going to have disposable income. What they do with that, we don't know. If they never used soft drugs or alcohol before, it seems that it, you know, we don't know what they will do with more money in their pocket. It may be limited to people that are already using those substances. I don't know what the initiation is of those.
And speaking more broadly, if cannabis is legalized, then you would hope that the government would tax cannabis at similar rates, at least. Similarly, regarding alcohol, you would hope that the government would continue to have high taxes on alcohol in order to discourage discourage high-risk drinking.
Perfect. Now, we just have two questions, and they're not directly related to what we were discussing today, but I thought maybe you'd be able to direct these people to where they can go to discuss these questions. We have one on what efforts are being made to encourage band councils, Aboriginal band councils, to address the situation of smoking in restaurants on reserve. And then we also have a question about how and where can ODB patients gain access to free NRT. So just wondering if you have any sense of where these people can go to get insurance.
So for ODB patients get free access to Zyban and Champix, but not to NRT, so they would have to access free NRT as they can through places where it is being offered for free. So those are in some family health teams and some community health centers, for example. Regarding the work with Aboriginal communities, we've been involved in a major study on researching commercial tobacco reduction in Aboriginal communities. And one of my key learnings from that is that these are not things that can be imposed from the outside. What needs to happen, in my view, for Aboriginal communities is working very closely with the communities themselves to get themselves on board and to support them as they seek in developing policies regarding protection, prevention, and cessation.
Perfect. I want to thank you very much for being here today and answering all the questions that we had. Thanks for everyone who have joined the webinar. Following this webinar, you will be sent an email that will contain a link to the evaluation survey. If everyone could kindly take a few moments to complete the evaluation, it will be greatly appreciated. Your input will help us improve webinars and host future learning opportunities that meet your needs. Thanks, everyone. Have a wonderful day.